wizard seemed to grow still taller and more terrible as his voice rose louder.
"You have made them all targets, and targets they will remain, until you prove, the only way it can be proven, that you are no longer willing to pay such prices."
"And is it true?"
Harry said. There was a buzzing sensation filling him, his body growing more distant.
"What Draco said, that Narcissa Malfoy never got her hands dirty, that she was only Lucius's wife. She was an enabler, I get that, but I can't back that deserving being burned alive."
"Nothing less would have convinced them that I was done with hesitation."
The old wizard's voice brooked no question and no refusal.
"Always I was too reluctant to do as I must. Always it was others who paid the cost of my mercy. So Alistair told me from the beginning. But I did not listen to him. You, I expect, shall prove better at such decisions than I."
"I'm surprised,"
Harry said, amazed that his voice was almost steady.
"I would have expected the Death Eaters to go after another Light family and start a cycle of escalating retaliation if you didn't get them all with your first strike."
"If my opponent had been Lucius, perhaps."
Dumbledore's eyes were like stones.
"I am told that Voldemort laughed at the news and proclaimed to his Death Eaters that I had finally grown and was at last a worthy opponent. Perhaps he was right. After the day I condemned my brother to his death, I began to weigh those who followed me, balancing them one against another, asking who I would risk and who I would sacrifice. To what end? It was strange how many fewer pieces I lost once I knew what they were worth."
Harry's jaw seemed locked, like it took a massive effort to make his lips move.
"But then it's not like Lucius was deliberately taking Hermione for ransom,"
Harry's voice said thinly.
"From Lucius's perspective, someone else broke the truce first. So, with that in mind, how many galleons was Hermione worth, exactly? Leaving aside the Danegeld thing, if it was just some ordinary threat to her life, how much should I have paid to save her? 10,000 galleons? 5,000?
The old wizard did not answer.
"It's a funny thing,"
Harry said, his voice wavering like something seen through water.
"Do you know, the day I went in front of the Dementor, what my worst memory was? It was my parents dying. I heard their voices and everything."
The old wizard's eyes widened behind the half-moon glasses.
"And here's the thing,"
Harry said.
"Here's the thing I've been thinking about over and over. The Dark Lord gave Lily Potter the chance to walk away. He said that she could flee. He told her that dying in front of the crib wouldn't save her baby. Step aside, foolish woman, if you have any sense at all."
An awful chill came over Harry as he spoke those words from his own lips, but he shook it off and continued.
"And afterward I kept thinking, I couldn't seem to stop myself from thinking. Wasn't the Dark Lord right? If only Mother had stepped away. She tried to curse the Dark Lord, but it was suicide. She had to have known that it was suicide. Her choice wasn't between her life and mine. Her choice was for herself to live, or for both of us to die. If she'd only done the logical thing and walked away... I mean, I love Mum too, but Lily Potter would be alive right now, and she would be my mother.
Tears were blurring Harry's own eyes.
Only now I understand. I know what Mother must have felt. She couldn't step aside from the crib. She couldn't. Love doesn't walk away.
It was like the old wizard had been struck. Struck by a chisel that shattered him straight down the middle.
"What have I said?"
the old wizard whispered.
"What have I said to you?"
"I don't know," shouted Harry. "I wasn't listening either."
I'm sorry, Harry.
The old wizard pressed his hands to his face, and Harry saw that Albus Dumbledore was weeping.
"I should not have said such things to you. I should not have resented your innocence."
Harry stared at the wizard for another second, and then Harry turned and marched out of the black room, down the stairs, through the office.
"I really don't know why you're still on his shoulder," Harry said to Fawkes.
Out the oaken door, and into the endlessly turning spiral. Harry had arrived in the Transfiguration classroom before anyone else, before even Professor McGonagall. There was charms class earlier, for his year, but that he hadn't even bothered trying to attend. Whether Professor McGonagall would make today's class, he didn't know. There was something ominous about all the empty desks beside him, the absence at the board, as if he stood alone in Hogwarts, with all his friends departed. According to the class schedule, today's lesson was on sustained transfigurations, all the rules of which Harry had learned by heart back when he was transfiguring a huge rock into the small diamond that shone on his pinky finger. It would be a theoretical subject, rather than practical, for the rest of the class, which was a pity, because he could have used a dose of Transfiguration's trance. Harry noted distantly that his hand was trembling, to the point where he had trouble undoing the pouch's drawstring as he drew forth the Transfiguration textbook.
"You were monstrously unfair to Dumbledore," said the voice Harry had been calling Slytherin, only now it also seemed to be the voice of economic sensibility, and maybe also conscience.
Harry's eyes dropped down to his textbook, but the section was so familiar it might as well have been a blank parchment.
"Dumbledore fought a war against a Dark Lord who deliberately set out to break him in the cruelest possible way. He had to choose between losing his war and his brother. Albus Dumbledore knows. He learned in the worst possible way that there are limits to the value of one life, and it almost broke his sanity to admit it. But you, Harry Potter, you already knew better."
"Shut up,"
the boy whispered to the empty Transfiguration classroom, though there was nobody there to hear it.
You already read about Philip Tetlock's experiments on people asked to trade off a sacred value against a secular one. Like a hospital administrator who has to choose between spending $1 million on a liver to save a 5-year-old and spending $1 million to buy other hospital equipment or pay physicians' salaries. And the subjects in the experiment became indignant and wanted to punish the hospital administrator for even thinking about the choice. Do you remember reading about that, Harry Potter? Do you remember thinking how very stupid that was? Since if hospital equipment and doctor salaries didn't also save lives, there would be no point in having hospitals or doctors. Should the hospital administrator have paid £1 billion for that liver, even if it meant the hospital going bankrupt the next day?
Shut up!
The boy whispered.
Every time you spend money in order to save a life with some probability, you establish a lower bound on the monetary value of a life. Every time you refuse to spend money to save a life with some probability, you establish an upper bound on the monetary value of life. If your upper bounds and lower bounds are inconsistent, it means you could move money from one place to another and save more lives at the same cost. So, if you want to use a bounded amount of money to save as many lives as possible, your choices must be consistent with some monetary value assigned to a human life. If not, then you could reshuffle the same money and do better. How very sad. How very hollow the indignation of those who refuse to say that money and life can ever be compared, when all they're doing is forbidding the strategy that saves the most people, for the sake of pretentious moral grandstanding. You knew that, and you still said what you did to Dumbledore. You deliberately tried to hurt Dumbledore's feelings. He's never tried to hurt you, Harry Potter. Not once.
Harry's head dropped into his hands. Why had Harry said what he had said to a sad, old, ancient wizard who'd fought hard and endured more than anyone should ever have to endure? Even if the old wizard was wrong, did he deserve to be hurt for it, after all that had happened to him? Why was there a part of him that seemed to get angry at the old wizard beyond reason, lashing out at him harder than Harry had ever hit anyone, without thought of moderation once the rage had been raised, only to quiet as soon as Harry left his presence?
Is it because you know Dumbledore won't fight back, that no matter what you say to him, however unfair, he'll never use his own power against you? He'll never treat you the way you treat him. Is this the way you treat people when you know they won't hit back? James Potter's bullying genes, manifesting at last.
Harry closed his eyes. Like the Sorting Hat speaking inside his head,
"What is the real reason for your anger? What do you fear?"
A whirlwind of images seemed to flash through Harry's mind then. The past Dumbledore weeping into his hands, the present form of the old wizard, standing tall and terrible. A vision of Hermione screaming in her chains in the metal chair as Harry abandoned her to the Dementors, and an imagination of a woman with long white hair. Had she looked like her husband, falling amid the flames of her bedroom as a wand was held upon her and orange light reflected from half-moon glasses. Albus Dumbledore had seemed to think that Harry would be better at that sort of thing than him. And Harry knew that he probably would be. He knew the maths, after all. But it was understood, somehow it was understood, that utilitarian ethicists didn't actually rob banks so they could give the money to the poor. The end result of throwing away all ethical constraint wouldn't actually be sunshine and roses and happiness for all. The prescription of consequentialism was to take the action that led to the best net consequences, not actions that had one positive consequence and wrecked everything else along the way. Expected utility maximizers were allowed to take common sense into account when they were calculating their expectations. Somehow, Harry had understood that. Even before anyone else had warned him, he'd understood. Before he'd read about Vladimir Lenin or the history of the French Revolution, he'd known. It might have been his earliest science fiction books warning him about people with good intentions. Or maybe Harry had just seen the logic for himself. Somehow he'd known from the very beginning that if he stepped outside his ethics, whenever there was a reason, the end result wouldn't be good. A final image came to him then. Lily Potter standing in front of her baby's crib and measuring the intervals between outcomes. The final outcome, if she stayed and tried to curse her enemy, dead Lily, dead Harry. The final outcome, if she walked away, live Lily, dead Harry. Weighing the expected utilities and making the only sensible choice. She would have been Harry's mother if she had.
But human beings can't live like that.
The boy's lips whispered to the empty classroom.
Human beings can't live like that.
Chapter 83. Taboo Trade-Offs. Aftermath 1. When Padma entered the Transfiguration classroom, she saw that half the class had beaten her there. A strange, deathly silence pervading the room. Harry Potter sat alone in one corner, staring off into some unknown distance, his eyes half-lidded, nearly closed. Rumour said that the Aurors had discovered that the defence professor had polyjuiced as Granger to fool Malfoy. Rumour said that Hermione had been bound by the unbreakable vow to be Draco Malfoy's slave. Rumour said that Hermione had gotten the Dementor's kiss. But if that were true, Harry Potter wouldn't be sitting there. He would be... Padma didn't know what General Potter would do. Her mind went blank, trying to think about it. Even when Professor McGonagall got there, the silence hadn't broken. The Transfiguration Professor walked up to the board without a pause, erased it with a sweep of her hand, and then began to write.
"Today, children,"
began the calm, professional voice of the Transfiguration Professor, just as though nothing out of the ordinary had happened that week.
"We shall learn how much effort it takes to sustain a transfiguration, and why, at your age, you should not even try. The original form is not gone, only suppressed, and to maintain that suppression."
"Excuse me,"
said Padma Patil. She knew her voice was shaking. She knew that she was trembling visibly, but she had to ask.
"Excuse me, Professor, what happened with Miss Granger?"
The Transfiguration Professor paused at the board and turned to look at Padma. The professor should have looked stern, having been interrupted without a hand being raised, but instead her face was kindly.
"You don't already know, Miss Patil. I expected that rumour would have spread."
"There's too many rumours," said Padma. "I don't know what's true."
Morag MacDougall raised her hand, then said, without waiting to be called,
"I told you, Padma, what's true is that the Wizengamot found Granger guilty and ordered her to get the Dementor's kiss, and they brought in the Dementor, and Harry Potter glued it to the ceiling and wouldn't let it down until—"
"Oh, dear Merlin,"
said Professor McGonagall, her expression growing sharp, but then she visibly calmed herself.
"The affair was utterly ridiculous, and I shan't go into detail. Let it stand that Miss Granger is resting with Madame Pomfrey for now, and coming back to classes tomorrow. And if I catch anyone bothering her, I shall turn them into glass vases and drop them."
The entire class gasped at this. It wasn't so much that the threat was fatal, as that it broke the safety rules for transfiguration. Professor McGonagall turned back to her board. From a corner of the classroom, another voice rose up.
"What about Professor Quirrell?" said Terry Boot. "Has he been arrested?"
"The Aurors are only detaining him,"
said the Transfiguration Professor without turning around.
"If they've not given back our defence, Professor Bay, tomorrow, I shall ask the headmaster to go fetch him. Though I may as well tell you now that the Board of Governors has scheduled a vote on whether Professor Quirrell's battles shall be allowed to continue."
Kevin Entwistle spoke.
"And General Malfoy, when's he getting back from St. Mungo's?"
The Transfiguration Professor paused in her drawing. She turned around again, more slowly this time.
"I am sorry, Mr. Entwistle," said Professor McGonagall.
Her face looked a little more lined than when she had entered the room.
"Mr. Malfoy's health is in no danger, I'm given to understand. Unfortunately, I have received an owl from Mr. Malfoy's father, withdrawing him from Hogwarts. I'm afraid he's not coming back."
Chapter 84. Taboo Trade-Offs. Aftermath 2. When Hermione Granger woke, she found herself lying in a soft, comfortable bed of the Hogwarts infirmary, with a square of setting sunlight falling on her midriff, warm through the thin blanket. Memory said that there would be a screen sheet above her, either drawn around her bed or open, and that the rest of Madame Pomfrey's domain would lie beyond. The other beds, occupied or unoccupied, and bright windows set in the curvily carven stone of Hogwarts. When Hermione opened her eyes, the first thing she saw was the face of Professor McGonagall sitting on the left side of her bed. Professor Flitwick wasn't there, but that was understandable. He'd stayed by her side all morning in the detention cell, his silver raven standing extra guard against the Dementor, and his stern little face always turned outward toward the Aurors. The head of Ravenclaw had surely spent way too much time on her, and probably had to get back to teaching his classes, instead of keeping watch on a convicted, attempted murderess. She felt horribly, horribly sick, and she didn't think it was because of any potions. Hermione would have started crying again, only her throat hurt, her eyes still burned, and her mind just felt tired. She couldn't have borne to weep again, couldn't find the strength for tears.
Where are my parents?
Hermione whispered to the head of House Gryffindor. Somehow it seems like the worst thing in the world to face them. Even worse than everything else. And yet she still wanted to see them. The gentle look on Professor McGonagall's face transfigured into something sadder.
I'm sorry, Miss Granger. Though it was not always so, we have found in recent years that it is wiser not to tell the parents of Muggleborns about any danger their child has faced. I should advise you also to remain silent, if you wish to stay at Hogwarts without trouble from them.
I'm not being expelled,
the girl whispered.
For what I did?
No,
said Professor McGonagall.
Miss Granger, surely you heard. I hope you heard Mr. Potter when he said that you were innocent.
He was just saying that,
she said dully.
To get me free, I mean.
The older witch shook her head firmly.
No, Miss Granger. Mr. Potter believes you were memory-charmed, that the whole duel never happened. The headmaster suspects even darker magics may have been involved, that your own hand might have cast the spell, but not your own will. Even Professor Snape finds the affair completely unbelievable, though he may not be able to say so publicly. He was wondering if Muggle drugs might have been used on you.
Hermione's eyes went on staring distantly at the Transfiguration Professor. She knew that she'd just been told something significant, but she couldn't find the energy to propagate any changes through her mind.
Surely you don't believe it, said Professor McGonagall. Miss Granger, you cannot believe of yourself that you would turn to murder.
But I...
Her excellent memory replayed it for the thousandth time, Draco Malfoy telling her with a sneer that she'd never beat him when he wasn't tired, and then proceeding to prove just that, dancing like a duelist between the warded trophies while she frantically scrambled, and dealing the ending blow with a hex that sent her crashing against the wall and drew blood from her cheek. And then she had...
But you remember doing it,
said the older witch, who was watching over her with kindly understanding.
Miss Granger, there is no need for a 12-year-old girl to bear such dreadful memories. Say the word, and I shall be happy to lock them away for you.
It was like a glass of warm water thrown into her face.
What?
Professor McGonagall took out her wand, a gesture so practiced and quick that it seemed like pointing a finger.
I can't offer to rid you of the memories entirely, Miss Granger,
the Transfiguration Professor said with her customary precision.
There may be important facts buried there, but there is a form of the memory charm which is reversible, and I shall be happy to cast that on you.
Hermione stared at the wand, feeling the stirrings of hope for the first time in almost 2 days.
Make it didn't happen.
She had wished that over and over again, for the hands of time to turn back and erase the horrible choice that could never, ever be undone. And if erasing the memory wasn't that, it was still a kind of release. She looked back at Professor McGonagall's kindly face.
You really don't think I did it?
Hermione said, her voice trembling.
I am quite certain you would never do such a thing of your own will.
Beneath her blankets, Hermione's hand clutched at the sheets.
Harry doesn't think I did it.
Mr. Potter is of the opinion that your memories are entire fabrications. I can rather see his point.
Then Hermione's clutching fingers let go of the sheet, and she slumped back into the bed from which she'd partially risen. No. She hadn't said anything. She had woken up and remembered what had happened last night. And it had been like she couldn't find the words, even in her own thoughts, for what it had been like. But she had known that Draco Malfoy was already dead. And she hadn't said anything. Hadn't gone to Professor Flitwick and confessed. She'd just dressed herself and gone down to breakfast and tried to act normal, so that nobody would ever know. And she'd known it was wrong, and wrong, and horribly, horribly wrong. But she'd been so, so scared. Even if Harry Potter was right, even if the duel with Draco Malfoy was a lie, she had made that choice all by herself. She didn't deserve to forget that, or be forgiven for it. And if she had done the right thing, gone straight to Professor Flitwick, maybe that would have helped, somehow. Maybe everyone would have seen that she had regretted it, and Harry wouldn't have had to give away all his money to save her. Hermione shut her eyes, squeezed them shut really tight. She couldn't bear to start crying again.
"I'm a horrible person," she said in a wavering voice. "I'm awful. I'm not heroic at all."
Professor McGonagall's voice was very sharp, like Hermione had just made some dreadful mistake on her transfiguration homework.
"Stop being foolish, Miss Granger. Horrible is whoever did this to you. And as for being heroic, well, Miss Granger, you've already heard my opinion about young girls trying to involve themselves in such things before they're even 14. So, I shall not lecture you on it again. I shall say only that you have just had an absolutely dreadful experience, which you survived as well as any witch in your year possibly could. Today, you are allowed to cry as much as you like. Tomorrow, you're going back to class."
That was when Hermione knew that Professor McGonagall couldn't help her. She needed someone to scold her. She couldn't be absolved if she couldn't be blamed, and Professor McGonagall would never do that for her. Would never ask so much of a little Ravenclaw girl. It was something Harry Potter wouldn't help her with either. Hermione turned over in the infirmary bed, huddling into herself, away from Professor McGonagall.
"Please,"
she whispered.
"I want to talk to the headmaster."
"Hermione."
When Hermione Granger opened her eyes a second time, she saw the care-lined face of Albus Dumbledore leaning over her bedside, looking almost as though he had been crying, though that was impossible. And Hermione felt another stabbing pang of guilt for having bothered him so.
"Minerva said you wished to speak with me,"
the old wizard said.
"I..."
Suddenly Hermione didn't know at all what to say. Her throat locked up, and all she could do was stammer,
I'm...
Somehow her tone must have communicated the other word, the one she couldn't even say any more.
"Sorry," said Dumbledore. "Why, for what should you be sorry?"
She had to force the words out of her throat.
You were telling Harry that he shouldn't pay, so I shouldn't have done what Professor McGonagall said. I shouldn't have touched his wand.
My dear, said Dumbledore, had you not pledged yourself to the House of Potter, Harry would have attacked Azkaban single-handedly and quite possibly won. That boy may choose his words carefully, but I have never yet known him to lie. And in the boy who lived, there is power that the Dark Lord never knew. He would indeed have tried to break Azkaban, even at cost of his own life.
The old wizard's voice grew gentler and kinder.
No, Hermione, you have nothing at all for which to blame yourself.
I could have made him not do it.
In Dumbledore's eyes, a small twinkle appeared before it was lost to weariness.
Really, Miss Granger, perhaps you should be headmistress in my place, for I myself have no such power over stubborn children.
Harry promised.
Her voice stopped. The awful truth was very hard to speak.
Harry Potter promised me that he would never help me if I told him not to.
There was a pause. The distant noises of the infirmary that had accompanied Professor McGonagall had ceased, Hermione realized, when Dumbledore had awoken her. From where she lay in bed, she could see only the ceiling and the top of one wall's windows, but nothing in her range of vision moved, and if there were sounds, she could not hear them.
"Ah,"
said Dumbledore. The old wizard sighed heavily.
"I suppose it is possible that the boy would have kept his promise."
I should have
gone to Azkaban of your own will," Dumbledore said. "Miss Granger, that is more than I would ever ask anyone to take upon themselves."
But,
Hermione swallowed. She couldn't help but notice the loophole. Anyone who wanted to get through the portrait door to the Ravenclaw dorm quickly learned to pay attention to exact wordings.
But it's not more than you'd take on yourself.
Hermione,
the old wizard began.
Why?
Said Hermione's voice. It seemed to be running on without her mind now.
Why couldn't I be braver? I was going to run in front of the Dementor, for Harry, in January. So why couldn't I?
Why had the thought of being sent to Azkaban just completely unglued her? Why had she forgotten everything about being good?
"My dear girl," Dumbledore said.
The blue eyes behind the half-moon glasses showed a complete understanding of her guilt.
"I would have done no better myself in my first year in Hogwarts. As you would be kind to others, be kinder to yourself as well."
"So I did do the wrong thing."
Somehow, she needed to say that, to be told that, even though she already knew. There was a pause.
"Listen, young Ravenclaw," the old wizard said. "Hear me well, for I shall speak to you a truth. Most ill-doers do not think of themselves as evil. Indeed, most conceive themselves the heroes of the stories they tell. I once thought that the greatest evil in this world was done in the name of the greater good. I was wrong. Terribly wrong. There is evil in this world which knows itself for evil, and hates the good with all its strength. All fair things does it desire to destroy.
Hermione shivered in her bed. Somehow it seemed very real when Dumbledore said it. The old wizard continued speaking.
You are one of the fair things of this world, Hermione Granger. And so that evil hates you as well. If you had stayed firm through even this trial, it would have struck you harder, and yet harder, until you shattered. Do not think that heroes cannot be broken. We are only more difficult to break, Hermione.
The old wizard's eyes had grown sterner than she had ever seen.
When you have been exhausted for many hours, when pain and death is not a passing fear but a certainty, then it is harder to be a hero. If I must speak the truth, then today, yes, I would not waver in the face of Azkaban. But when I was a first year in Hogwarts, I would have fled from the Dementor that you confronted, for my father had died in Azkaban, and I feared them. Know this, the evil that struck at you could have broken anyone, even myself. Only Harry Potter has it within him to face that horror when he has come fully into his power.
Hermione's neck couldn't stare at the old wizard any longer. She let her head fall back to the pillow, where she stared up at the ceiling, absorbing what she could.
Why?
Her voice trembled again.
Why would anyone be that evil? I don't understand.
I, too, have wondered,
said Dumbledore's voice, a deep sadness in it.
For thrice 10 years, I wondered, and I still do not understand. You and I will never understand, Hermione Granger. But at least I know now what true evil would say for itself, if we could speak to it and ask why it was evil. It would say, why not?
A brief flare of indignation inside her.
There's got to be a million reasons why not.
Indeed, said Dumbledore's voice. A million reasons and more. We will always know those reasons, you and I. If you insist on putting it that way, then yes, Hermione, this day's trial broke you. But what happens after you break, that, too, is part of being a hero, which you are, Hermione Granger, and will always be.
She raised her head again, staring at him. The old wizard got up from beside her bed. His silver beard dipped down as Dumbledore bowed to her gravely and left. She went on looking at where the old wizard had gone. It should have meant something to her. Should have touched her. Should have made her feel better inside that Dumbledore, who had seemed so reluctant before, had now acknowledged her as a hero. She felt nothing. Hermione let her head fall back to the bed as Madame Pomfrey came and made her drink something that seared her lips like the afterburn of spicy food, and smelled even hotter, and didn't taste like anything at all. It meant nothing to her. She went on, staring up at the distant stone tiles of the ceiling. Minerva was waiting, doing her best not to hover beside the double doors to the Hogwarts infirmary. She'd always thought of those doors as the ominous gates as a child in Hogwarts, and couldn't help but remember that now. Too much bad news had been spoken here. Albus stepped out. The old wizard didn't pause on the way out of the infirmary, only kept walking toward Professor Flitwick's office, and Minerva followed him. Professor McGonagall cleared her throat.
Is it done, Albus?
The old wizard nodded in affirmation.
If any hostile magic is cast on her, or any spirit touches her, I shall know and come.
I spoke to Mr. Potter after transfiguration class, said Professor McGonagall. He was of the opinion that Miss Granger should go to Beauxbatons rather than Hogwarts from now on.
The old wizard shook his head.
No. If Voldemort truly desires to strike at Miss Granger, he is tenacious beyond measure. His servants are returning to him. He could not have retrieved Bellatrix alone. Azkaban itself is not safe from his malice. And as for Beauxbatons, no, Minerva. I do not think Voldemort can essay such possessions often, or against stronger targets, or this year would have gone quite differently. And Harry Potter is here, whom Voldemort must fear, whether he admits it or no. Now that I have warded her, Miss Granger will be safer within Hogwarts than without.
Mr. Potter seemed to doubt that,
Minerva said. She couldn't quite keep the edge from her voice. There was a part of her that agreed rather strongly.
He seemed to feel that common sense said Miss Granger should continue her education anywhere but Hogwarts.
The old wizard sighed.
Ah, I fear the boy has spent too much time among the Muggles. Always they reach for safety. Always they imagine that safety can be reached. If Miss Granger is not safe within the center of our fortress, she shall be no safer for leaving it.
Not everyone seems to think so,
said Professor McGonagall. It had been almost the first letter she had seen when she had taken a quick look at her desk. An envelope of the finest sheepskin, sealed in greenish silver wax, pressed into the image of a snake that rose and hissed at her.
I have received Lord Malfoy's owl withdrawing his son from Hogwarts.
The old wizard nodded, but did not break stride.
Does Harry know?
Yes.
Her voice faltered for a moment, remembering Harry's expression.
After class, Mr. Potter complimented Lord Malfoy's excellent good sense and said that he would be writing Madame Longbottom, advising her to do the same with her grandson, in case he was the next target. In the event that Mr. Longbottom's guardian was so negligent as to keep him in Hogwarts, Mr. Potter wanted him to have a tane-turner, an invisibility cloak, a broomstick, and a pouch in which to carry them. Also a touring with an emergency portkey to a safe location in case someone kidnaps Mr. Longbottom and takes him outside Hogwarts wards. I told Mr. Potter that I did not think the Ministry would consent to such use of tane-turners, and he said that we should not ask. I expect he'll want Miss Granger to receive the same, if she stays. And as for himself, Mr. Potter wants a 3-person broomstick to carry in his pouch.
She wasn't awed by the list of precautions, impressed with the cleverness, but not awed. She was a transfiguration mistress, after all, but it still sent shivers of disquiet through her, that Harry Potter now thought Hogwarts as dangerous as spell research.
"The Department of Mysteries is not lightly defied," said Albus. "But for the rest..."
The old wizard seemed to slump on himself slightly.
"We may as well give the boy what he wishes. And I will ward Neville also, and write Augusta to say that he should stay here over the holiday."
"And finally,"
she said,
"Mr. Potter says..." This is a direct quote, Albus. "Whatever kind of dark wizard attractant the headmaster is keeping here, he needs to get it out of this school now."
She couldn't stop the edge in her own voice that time.
"I asked as much of Flamel,"
Albus said, the pain clear in his voice.
"But Master Flamel has said that even he can no longer keep safe the stone, that he believes Voldemort has means of finding it wherever it is hidden, and that he does not consent for it to be guarded anywhere but Hogwarts. Minerva, I am sorry, but it must be done. Must!"
"Very well,"
said Professor McGonagall.
"But for myself, I think that Mr. Potter is right on every single count."
The old wizard glanced at her, and his voice caught as he said,
"Minerva, you have known me long, and as well as any soul still living. Tell me, have I lost myself to darkness already?"
"What?"
said Professor McGonagall in genuine surprise. Then,
"Oh, Albus, no!"
The old wizard's lips pressed together tightly before he spoke.
"For the greater good. I have sacrificed so many for the greater good. Today, I almost condemned Hermione Granger to Azkaban, for the greater good. And I find myself today, I found myself, beginning to resent the innocence that is no longer mine."
The old wizard's voice halted.
"Evil done in the name of good. Evil done in the name of evil. Which is worse?"
"You're being silly, Albus."
The old wizard glanced at her again, before turning his eyes back to their way.
"Tell me, Minerva, did you pause to weigh the consequences before you told Miss Granger how to bind herself to the Potter family?"
She took an involuntary breath as she understood what she had done.
"So, you did not?"
Albus's eyes were saddened.
"No, Minerva, you must not apologize. It is well, for what you have seen of me this day if your first loyalty is now to Harry Potter, and not to me, then that is right and proper."
She opened her lips to protest, but Albus went on before she could say a word.
"Indeed, indeed. That will be necessary, and more than necessary, if the Dark Lord that Harry must defeat to come into his power is not Voldemort after all."
"Not this again,"
Minerva said.
"Albus, it was you know who, not you, who marked Harry as his equal. There is no possible way that the prophecy could be talking about you."
The old wizard nodded, but his eyes still seemed distant, fixed only on the road ahead. The holding cell, well to the centre of magical law enforcement, was luxuriously appointed. More a remark on what adult wizards took for granted than any special feeling toward prisoners. There was a self-reclining, self-rocking chair with plush, richly textured, self-warming cushions. There was a bookcase containing random books rescued from a bargain bin, and a full shelf of ancient magazines, including one from 1883. As for toiletries, well, it wasn't exactly luxurious, but there was a spell on the room which put all that business on hold. You weren't to go anywhere that the watching aura couldn't see you. But, aside from that, it was quite a pleasant little cell. The defense professor of Hogwarts was being detained, not arrested, not even intimidated. There was no evidence to indict him, except that a terrible and unusual crime had been committed at the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, and going by previous occasions, the odds were 5-1 that the current defense professor was tangled up in it somehow. To this must be added the fact that nobody in the DMLE even knew who the defense professor was, and that the man had literally sneezed at all attempts to uncover his true identity. Why, no, they hadn't released Quirinus Quirrell back to Hogwarts just yet. Let us repeat this for emphasis. The defense professor was being detained in a cell. The defense professor was staring at the watching aura and humming. The defense professor has not spoken a single word since he arrived in this particular cell. He has only been humming. The humming started as a simple children's lullaby, the one that in Muggle Britain begins, "Lullaby and good night." This tune was hummed, without variation, over and over for 7 minutes, to establish the underlying pattern. Then began the elaborations upon the theme. Phrases hummed too slow, with long pauses in between, so that the listener's mind helplessly waits, and waits for the next note, the next phrase. And then, when that next phrase comes, it is so out of key, so unbelievably, awfully out of key, not just out of key for the previous phrases, but sung at a pitch which doesn't correspond to any key, that you would have to believe this person had spent hours deliberately practicing their humming just to acquire such perfect anti-pitch. It bears the same semblance to music as the awful dead voice of a dementor bears to human speech. And this horrible, horrible humming is impossible to ignore. It is similar to a known lullaby,
but it departs from that pattern unpredictably. It sets up expectations and then violates them, never in any constant pattern that would permit the humming to fade into the background. The listener's brain cannot prevent itself from expecting the anti-musical phrases to complete, nor prevent itself from noticing the surprises. The only possible explanation for how this mode of humming came to exist is that it was deliberately designed by some unspeakably cruel genius who woke up one day, feeling bored with ordinary torture, who decided to handicap himself and find out whether he could break someone's sanity just by humming at them. The aura has been listening to this unimaginably dreadful humming for 4 hours, while being stared at by a huge, cold, lethal presence that feels equally horrible whether he looks at it directly or lets it hover at the corner of his vision. The humming stopped. There was a long wait, time enough for false hope to rise and be squashed down by the memory of previous disappointments. And then, as the interval lengthened and lengthened, that hope rose again unstoppably. The humming began once more. The aura cracked. From his belt, the aura took a mirror, tapped it once, and then said,
"This is Junior Aura Arjun Altane. I'm calling in code RJL20 on cell 3.
"Code RJL20, the mirror said in surprised tones. There was a sound of pages being flipped then. "You want to be relieved because a prisoner is attempting psychological warfare and succeeding?" Amelia Bones really is quite intelligent.
"What did the prisoner say to you?" said the mirror.
This question is not part of procedure RJL20, but, unfortunately, Amelia Bones has failed to include an explicit instruction that the commanding officer should not ask.
"He's..."
said the aura, and glanced back at the cell. The defense professor was now leaning back in his chair, looking quite relaxed.
"He was staring at me, and humming."
There was a pause. The mirror spoke again.
"And you're calling in an RJL20 over that? You're sure you're not just trying to get out of watching him?"
Amelia Bones is surrounded by idiots.
"You don't understand," yelled Aura Altane. "It's really awful humming."
The mirror transmitted a sound of muffled laughter in the background, sounding like it was coming from more than one person. Then, speech again.
"Mr. Altane, if you don't want to be busted to junior or a second class, I suggest you buckle down and get back to work."
"Strike that,"
a crisp voice said, sounding slightly remote due to its distance from the mirror. Which is why Amelia Bones often sits in on a coordination center of the DMLE while doing her ministry-required paperwork.
"Aura Altane,"
said the crisp voice, seeming to approach closer to the mirror.
"You will be relieved shortly. Aura Ben Gutierrez, the procedure for RJL20 does not say that you ask why. It says that you relieve the aura who calls it in. If I find that auras seem to be abusing it, I will modify the procedure to prevent its abuse."
The mirror cut off abruptly. The aura turned back to look triumphantly at where the current defense professor of Hogwarts was leaning back in his cushioned chair.
The man then spoke the first words that had left his lips since he entered the cell.
"Goodbye, Mr. Alternay," said the defense professor.
A few minutes later, the door to the detention cell opened, and in walked a gray-haired woman, dressed in the crimson-tinged robes of an aura, without any sign of rank or other ornamentation, carrying a black leather folder under her left arm.
"You are relieved," the old woman said abruptly.
There was a brief delay while Aura Alternay tried to explain what had been happening. This was cut short by a nod and a stark, simple finger pointing out the door.
"Good evening, Madam Director," said the defense professor.
Amelia Bones did not acknowledge this statement, but sat down abruptly in the vacated chair. The old witch opened the black folder, and her gaze moved down to the parchments therein.
"Possible hints to the identity of the current Hogwarts defense professor, as compiled by Aura Robards."
The title parchment was turned, flipped aside.
"The defense professor said that he was sorted into Slytherin, claimed that his family was killed by Voldemort, said he had studied at a martial arts center in Muggle Asia, which was destroyed by Voldemort. A request filed with the Department of International Magical Cooperation identifies this incident as the Oni affair of 1969.
Another parchment was flipped aside.
"It also seems this defense professor gave a most stirring speech to his students just before last Yule, castigating the previous generation for their disunity against the Death Eaters."
The old witch looked up from the leather folder.
"Madam Longbottom was rather taken with it, and insisted that I read the entire thing. The argument struck me as familiar, though I could not place it at the time. But then, of course, I had thought you dead."
The chief law enforcement officer of Magical Britain was now gazing sharply at the current defense professor of Hogwarts, across the pane of spell-reinforced glass separating them. The man in the cell returned the gaze equably, without apparent alarm.
"I shall not name any names," said the old witch, "but I shall tell a story, and see if it sounds familiar."
Amelia Bones looked back down, turning to the next parchment.
"Born 1927, entered Hogwarts in 1938, sorted into Slytherin, graduated 1945, went on a graduation tour abroad and disappeared while visiting Albania. Presumed dead until 1970, when he returned to Magical Britain just as suddenly, without any explanation for the missing 25 years. He remained estranged from his family and friends, living in isolation. In 1971, while visiting Diagon Alley, he fended off an attempt by Bellatrix Black to kidnap the daughter of the Minister of Magic, and used the killing curse to slay 2 of the 3 Death Eaters accompanying her. Beyond this, all Britain knows the story. Need I continue it?"
The old witch looked up from her folder again.
"Very well. There was a trial in the Wizengamot, during which this young man was exonerated for his use of the killing curse, not least due to the efforts of his grandmother, the lady of his house. He was reconciled with his family, and they held a house gathering to welcome his return. The guest of honor arrived at that gathering to find his entire family slain by Death Eaters, even to the house elves, and that he himself, of cadet line, was now the last remaining scion of a most ancient house.
The defense professor had not reacted at all to any of this, except that his eyes had half closed, as though in weariness. The young man took up his family's seat in the Wizengamot, becoming among the most steadfast voices against you-know-who. Several times he led forces against the Death Eaters, fighting with skillful tactics and extraordinary power. People began to speak of him as the next Dumbledore. It was thought that he might become Minister of Magic after the Dark Lord fell. On the 3rd of July, 1973, he failed to appear at a key Wizengamot vote, and was never heard from again. We assumed you-know-who had killed him. It was a grave blow to all of us, and matters went much worse from that day on. The old witch's gaze was questioning. I mourned you myself. What happened? The defense professor's shoulders moved slightly. A small shrug.
You make many assumptions, the defense professor said softly. For myself, I would believe that man died years ago. But if that man is nonetheless alive, then it is clear he does not wish the fact announced, and has reasons enough for silence. That man was once of some help to you, it seems.
The defense professor's lips curved in a cynical smile.
But I am no longer surprised when gratitude is fleeting. Is there yet more that you would demand from him?
The old witch leaned back in her aura's monitoring chair, looking rather startled, maybe even hurt.
No,
she said after a moment. Her fingers tapped the leather folder. Nervously, you might have thought, if you had believed that Amelia Bones could ever be nervous.
But your house, there are not many ancient houses remaining. It shall matter little to this country whether 8 ancient houses remain, or 7.
The old witch sighed.
What does Dumbledore think of this?
The man in the detention cell shook his head.
He does not know who I am, and promised not to inquire.
The old witch's eyebrows rose.
How did he identify you to the Hogwarts wards, then?
A slight smile.
The headmaster drew a circle, and told Hogwarts that he who stood within was the defense professor. Speaking of which...
The tone went lower, flatter.
I am missing my classes, Director Bones.
You seem to rest sometimes, in a peculiar manner. This has also been reported, and you seem to be resting more and more frequently as time goes on.
The old witch's fingers tapped the leather folder again.
I cannot recall reading of such a symptom, but when one hears of such a thing, one imagines... Dark wizards fought, and terrible curses received.
The defense professor remained expressionless.
Do you require a healer's help?
Said Amelia Bones. Her own mask had slipped, clearly showing the pain in her eyes.
Is there anything at all that can be done for you? I agreed to teach defense at Hogwarts,
the man in the cell said flatly.
Draw your own conclusions, madam. And
I am missing my classes, of which there are not many left. I would return to Hogwarts now."
When Hermione woke the third time, though it felt like she'd only closed her eyes for a moment, the sun was even lower in the sky, almost fully set. She felt a little more alive and, strangely, even more exhausted. This time it was Professor Flitwick who was standing next to her bed and shaking her shoulder. A tray of steaming food floated next to him. For some reason, she thought Harry Potter ought to be leaning over her bedside, but he wasn't there. Had she dreamed that? She couldn't remember dreaming. It developed, according to Professor Flitwick, that Hermione had missed dinner in the Great Hall and was being woken to eat, and then she could go back to the Ravenclaw dorm and her own bed to sleep the rest of the night. She ate in silence. There was a part of her that wanted to ask Professor Flitwick whether he thought she had been memory-charmed or she had tried to kill Draco of her own will, like she remembered doing. But most of her was afraid to find out. Afraid to find out was a warning sign, according to Harry Potter and his books, but her mind felt tired, bruised, and she couldn't muster the strength to override it. When she and Professor Flitwick left the infirmary, they found Harry Potter sitting cross-legged outside the door, quietly reading a psychology textbook.
"I'll take her from here," said the boy who lived. "Professor McGonagall said it would be all right."
Professor Flitwick seemed to accept this and departed after a stern look at both of them. She couldn't imagine what the stern look was supposed to say, unless it was, "Don't try to kill any more students." The footsteps of Professor Flitwick faded, and the two of them stood alone outside the doors of the infirmary. She looked at the green eyes of the boy who lived, the mess of hair that didn't quite obscure the scar on his forehead. She looked upon the face of the boy who had given all his money to save her without a second thought. There were feelings inside her. Guilt, shame, embarrassment, other things as well. But no words. There was nothing she knew how to say.
"So," Harry said abruptly, "I did a quick skim through my psychology books to see what they said about post-traumatic stress disorder. The old books said you should talk about the experience immediately afterward with a counsellor. The newer research says that when they actually ran experiments, it turned out that talking about it immediately afterward made it worse. Apparently, what you really ought to do is run with your mind's natural impulse to repress the memories and just not think about it for a while."
It was so normal for the way she and Harry usually talked that she felt a sudden burning in her throat. "We don't have to talk about it." That was what Harry had just said, more or less. It felt like cheating, maybe even like a lie. Nothing was normal. Everything wrong was still horribly wrong. Everything left unsaid still needed to be said.
"Okay,"
said Hermione, because there wasn't anything else to say. Anything else at all.
"I'm sorry I wasn't waiting when you woke up," Harry said as they started to walk. "Madame Pomfrey wouldn't let me in, so I just stayed out here."
He gave a small, sad-looking shrug.
I suppose I should be out there trying to run damage control on public relations, but honestly, I've never been good at that. I just end up speaking sharply at people. How bad is it?
She thought her voice should have come out in a whisper, a croak, but it didn't.
Well, Harry said with obvious hesitation, the thing you've got to understand, Hermione, is that you had a lot of defenders at breakfast time today, but everyone on your side was making stuff up. Draco tried to kill you first, things like that. It was Granger versus Malfoy. That's how people saw it. Like a seesaw where pushing his side down meant pushing your side up. I told them that you were probably both innocent, that you'd both been memory charmed. They didn't listen. Both sides treated me like a traitor trying to play the middle. And then people heard that Draco had testified under Veritaserum, that he'd been trying to help you before the battle. Stop making that expression, Hermione. You didn't actually do anything to him. Anyway, all people understand was that the pro-Malfoy faction had been right, and the pro-Granger faction had been wrong.
Harry gave a small sigh.
I told them that when the truth came out later, they'd be embarrassed.
How bad is it?
She said again. This time her voice did come out weaker.
Remember Ash's conformity experiment?
Harry said, turning his head to give her a serious look. Her mind was slow to remember for a few seconds, which frightened her. But then the reference came back. In 1951, Solomon Ash had taken some experimental subjects, and each one had been put among a row of other people who looked like them, seeming like other experimental subjects, but actually confederates of the experimenter. They'd shown a reference line on a screen labelled X, next to three other lines labelled A, B, and C. The experimenter had asked which line X was the same length as. The correct answer had obviously been C. The other subjects, the Confederates, had one after another said that X was the same length as B. The real subject had been put second to last in the order, so as to not arouse suspicion by being last. The test had been to see whether the real subject would conform to the standard wrong answer of B, or voice the obviously correct answer of C. 75% of the subjects had conformed at least once. A third of the subjects had conformed more than half the time. Some had reported afterward actually believing that X was the same length as B. And that had been in a case where the subject hadn't known any of the Confederates. If you put people around others who belonged to the same group as them, like someone in a wheelchair next to other people in a wheelchair, the conformity effect got even stronger. Hermione had a sickening feeling where this was going.
I remember,
she whispered.
I gave the Chaos Legion anti-conformity training, you know. I had each legionnaire stand in the middle and say, "Twice two is four," or "Grass is green," while everyone else in the Chaos Legion called them idiots or sneered at them. Alan Flint did really good sneers, or even just gave them blank looks and then walked away. The thing you've got to remember is, only the Chaos Legion has ever practiced anything like that. Nobody else in Hogwarts even knows what conformity is.
Harry!
Her voice was wobbling.
How bad It's...
Harry gave another sad-looking shrug. Everyone in the second year and above, since they don't know you, everyone in Dragon Army, all of Slytherin, of course, and, well, most of the rest of Magical Britain, too, I think. Remember, Lucius Malfoy controls the Daily Prophet.
Everyone?
She whispered. Her limbs had started to feel cold, like she'd just gotten out of an unheated swimming pool.
What people really believe doesn't feel like a belief. It feels like the way the world is. You and I are standing in a private little bubble of the universe where Hermione Granger got memory charmed. Everyone else is living in the world where Hermione Granger tried to murder Draco Malfoy. If Ernie Macmillan...
Her breath caught in her throat. Captain Macmillan...
thinks he's ethically prohibited from being your friend now, well, he's trying to do the right thing as he understands it, in the world he thinks he lives in.
Harry's eyes were very serious.
Hermione, you've told me a lot of times that I look down too much on other people. But if I expected too much of them, if I expected people to get things right, I really would hate them then. Idealism aside, Hogwarts students don't actually know enough cognitive science to take responsibility for how their own minds work. It's not their fault they're crazy.
Harry's voice was strangely gentle, almost like an adult's.
I know it's going to be harder on you than it would be on me. But remember, eventually the real culprit gets nailed. The truth comes out. Everyone who was confidently wrong gets embarrassed.
And if the real culprit doesn't get caught?
She said in a trembling voice.
Or if it turns out to be me, after all?
Then you can leave Hogwarts and go to the Salem Witches Institute in America.
Leave Hogwarts?
She'd never even thought of that possibility except as an ultimate punishment.
Hermione, I think you might want to do that anyway. Hogwarts isn't a castle. It's insanity with walls. You have got other options.
Oh,
she stammered.
I'll have to think about it.
Harry nodded.
At least nobody's going to try hexing you. Not after what the headmaster said at dinner tonight. Oh, and Ron Weasley came up to me, looking very serious, and told me that if I saw you first, I should tell you that he's sorry for having thought badly of you, and he'll never speak ill of you again.
Ron believes I'm innocent,
said Hermione.
Well, he doesn't think you're innocent, per se.
The whole Ravenclaw dorm went silent as the two of them walked in, staring at them. Staring at her. She had had nightmares like this. And then, one by one, people looked away from her. Penelope Clearwater, the fifth-year prefect in charge of first years, looked away slowly and deliberately, turning her head to face in another direction. Sue Lee and Lisa Turpin and Michael Corner, all sitting at a table together, all of whom she'd helped with their homework at one time or another, all looked away, their faces suddenly nervous the moment she tried to catch their eyes. A third-year witch named Letitia Randall, whom Spew had twice saved from Slytherin bullies,
quickly bent back over her desk and started doing homework again. Mandy Brocklehurst looked away from her. If Hermione didn't burst into tears then, it was only because she had expected it, had played it out in her mind over and over again. At least people weren't screaming at her, or shoving her, or hexing her. They were just looking away. Hermione walked very straight up to the staircase that led toward the first-year girls' dorms. She didn't see Padma Patil or Anthony Goldstein looking at her, those two lone heads turning to track her as she left. From behind her, she heard Harry Potter saying in a very calm tone,
"Now, eventually, the truth's going to come out, you all. So, if you're all that confident she's guilty, can I ask you all to sign this paper right here, saying that if she later turns out to be innocent, she gets to say, 'I told you so,' and then hold it over you for the rest of your lives. Step on up, one and all. Don't be cowards. If you really believe, you shouldn't be afraid to bet."
She was halfway up the stairs when she realized that there would be other girls inside her dorm room too. The stars hadn't quite come out yet. Only one or two of the brightest ones visible through the reddish-purple haze of the horizon, though the sun had fully sunk. Hermione's hands dug into the harsh stone of the parapet guarding the small balcony, where she'd ducked out of the stairwell after realizing that she couldn't just go back to bed. The words echoed in her mind like, "You can't go home again," ought to sound. She stared out at the empty grounds.